Good morning and welcome. I'm honored to be here and conducting this keynote lecture and panel afterwards. It's regarding ethics in science, which is the most of the talks of the past previous days that we actually heard from different perspectives on the other panels. But firstly, I would like to introduce you Professor Charlie Hendricks, Head of Department and Professor of Agricultural Economics from the University of Pretoria. And she's a very prominent scientist and security policy expert. And she contributed very much during her career in developing food security in Africa. So I'll ask Professor Sherry Hendricks to come to the stage and give us the introductory keynote speech. Welcome.
Thank you and good morning. It's an honor and a privilege to be able to have the opportunity to address you today on the topic of the conduct, the ethical conduct of science. So we know that science inquiry and communication of science are essential in achieving the universal goals related to development. In an era where evidence-based planning and decision-making is in vogue, we're called to contribute to a better and more sustainable life for all. Throughout the ages, such developments have embraced science, its independent discoveries and advice, trusting the integrity of scientists. But in today's world of fake news, polarized and vocal public voices, and significantly improved public access to a diversity of information sources, the integrity of science is challenged and often mistrusted. This is compounded by the publications of scandals in science. These bring into question the ethics of science and of scientists themselves. In my own university, we believe that research matters. It matters because not only does it produce knowledge, technology, and innovation that are important for societal development, but we also research and choose not what we choose and not to research, and what we choose to research also influences society. For all scientists, conducting science is our everyday business. We're curious about the world, what constitutes its components, its elements, and its substance. We observe change and ask questions about what drives this change. We are curious about what will drive change in the future and how what we know and what we don't know can shape and improve future well-being. We value the unknown and enjoy the challenge and excitement of discovery. The discovery of new knowledge, technologies, and innovations is exhilarating. While the pursuit of these moments requires extensive hard work, dedication, and long-term commitment, discoveries and the acclaim that they bring are not everyday happenings in the life of a scientist. Contrary to current drives in higher education to produce ready-for-work graduates, many of us were never formally trained in the ethics of being a scientist. Yes, we were trained in the knowledge and the skills and the technologies for our particular profession, and sometimes the ethics related to human and animal research, but really in the foundations of the ethics of being a scientist. We learned much of what we know about identifying research problems, selecting samples, collecting experiments, conducting experiments, analysis, writing up results and drawing conclusions, as well as how to publish and present research from our mentors, or perhaps sometimes simply on the job. Each of these research components demands integrity and the highest level of ethical behavior. When scientists are not honest, responsible, and acting independently, they bring the credibility of the scientific community into disrepute and mistrust, breaking the social and moral contract between science and society. Scientists have long maintained an informal system of ethics and guidelines for conducting research. But after a series of well-publicized ethical breaches and war crimes in the mid-20th century, numerous codes of ethics have been published. Some more recent cases of isolated individual dishonesty and misdemeanors have been reported. These rotten apples, of course, ruin the whole batch. But some involve the lack of independence of research institutions, especially where they have a specific influence on preventing policy change, in particular in the food and agricultural sector. Science ethics calls for honesty and integrity at all these stages of our scientific practice to produce unbiased knowledge, which is critical for others to build upon. So research misconduct can have devastating consequences to the perpetrator, to the person who reported the misconduct, and also to the institutions involved. Most scientists would be quick to say that we're not dishonest, and we certainly don't make it our effort to mislead society. But societal trust is encoded by such incidences. Trust is fragile, and it's difficult to restore once it's been breached. So this requires greater caution in our everyday practicing of science. We cannot afford to be sloppy or inattentive in our responsibilities to conduct science in an irreproachable manner at every stage of the process. The fact that the current digital environment makes it more likely that any misconduct will be exposed makes our integrity now more than ever even more in the spotlight. So the ethical conduct of science is essential. It's the responsibility of each of us to make sure that we're familiar with the procedures and to train those who are under our mentorship. So for centuries, scientists have relied on each other, on the self-correcting mechanisms involved in the publication process, in publishing data, in peer review, making sure that our research is replicable, in collaboration with others, and to safeguard the integrity of this process. So science may ultimately be self-correcting, and genuine mistakes may well be able to be corrected even in published literature, but it tarnishes the reputation. The ethical conduct of science also includes upholding the safety requirements and respect of human rights and the humane treatment of animals. Of course, all of this falls outside of the scope of what is possible in a presentation such as this. I won't be exploring this. Many of these issues have been extensively discussed in other sessions, drawing to our attention the growing applications of artificial intelligence, digital technologies, and big data harvesting. These all bring new challenges. Many of the new elements have to be included in ethics applications, and due to these technologies, the need to protect personal privacy becomes even more important. So formally, research misconduct is defined as fabrication, falsification, or plagiarism in the proposing, performing, or reviewing of research, or in reporting of results. So of course, fabrication is about making up results. The famous Darwin Piltdown Man scandal is one of the scandals that had science fooled for 40 years. But falsification and manipulation of research materials, equipment, processes, or changing and omitting data are things that are less commonly seen, but yet we have to be so alert to. And these elements are seen in many of our publishing strategies. Two famous cases in Schoen and Slilsky show us that Slilsky, for example, was publishing one paper every 10 days and including the names of many authors who had no idea that they were actually being included in the fabricated research. So we have to be alert to many different components and the devious means of some people. Plagiarism, of course, is something that we are continuously presenting to our students and trying to make sure that they follow procedures, but it happens in professional science as well. So what motivates such behavior? The modern scientist faces intense competition, and it's further burdened by difficult and sometimes unreasonably regulatory environments. In addition, the changing nature of collaborative efforts, the quickening pace and increasing complexity of research endeavors, and the growing emphasis on commercialization of research outputs have combined to raise the stress for scientists. We live in a complex world, in public service and universities, in publicly and privately funded research institutions, or in the private sector itself. For those in public institutions, we are not divorced from either private or public influences, but increasingly expected to raise funds from the private sector while striving to attain increasingly complex performance targets. These performance targets are driven not only by performance on a personal level, but drive resource allocation at all levels of academic institutions, as well as in the ranking of institutions. So the race is on at a personal level, as well as at an institutional level. These criteria continually change, becoming more demanding and more complex to measure, the latest being our demand to report on SDG indicators. So falsification, fabrication, and plagiarism are some of the strategies used by ambitious scientists, but these are not the only ones. The massification of publication outputs is very common. Cookie-cutter research that reproduces and pushes up publication numbers, the carving up of reports to squeeze out the maximum number of papers, the incredible rise of predatory journals and that add to this list of misdemeanors. Their rise demonstrate the desperate state and the ethics of science conduct. We all know that credible journals are oversubscribed, the highest ranking journals often taking the longest to get papers out, while tightening the prescriptions on pre-press releases of research results. Yet the race is on to get those results published. The sheer number of submissions puts a significant strain on editors and associate editors of journals to identify this unethical conduct and misdemeanors and to choke out, to get rid of these threats that choke the reviewing process. This requires that editors act with extreme caution to identify these particular papers. Meanwhile, the turnaround and release of results constrains the progressive and iterative steps of building science knowledge. Scientists are not the only ones driven by performance targets. Under the constant scrutiny of government bodies, research and development funders, both public and private, are increasingly pressed to demonstrate impact, in particular, in impact in areas where there may not be rapid impact observed, or there may not be an impact for a very long time. But we have to keep to project cycles. So we need to develop, advance our careers, and show tangible policy impact. And increasingly, these performance systems and grant evaluations press for evidence of public engagement. In our eagerness to tick all the boxes on grant applications, project evaluations, and performance appraisals, how genuine is this engagement, really? The often well-intended incentive situations and performance benchmarks may well have unintended consequences for the ethics of science and for society at large. We see this sharply played out in the policy domain. The issue of ethical conduct of science is sharply under focus with respect to contemporary demand for evidence-based policy. Policies are constantly in flux. They change with regimes, with political persuasions, with international development agendas. They're at the same time generic, but yet context-specific. Policies drive resource allocation and determine public investment directions, including those for research and development. They guide the intervention choices of governments, their rollout, and their coverage. Although often intersectoral, they often have intersectorial impacts that cannot be ignored. While academic performance criteria for research evidence of policy influence and change should, in this context, should research lead to policy interface, or should we rather value the independence and integrity of science and find other mechanisms to synthesize the vast range of research required for policy considerations? As I've mentioned, the ethics of conduct of science influences the area and the choice of subject that we make for where we wish to make this impact in our lives. Topic selection is, of course, guided by our moral conscience and shaped by our ethics. In my domain, which is food policy analysis, this often leads to facing a crossroads between scientific rigor and the rights of human beings. For example, traditional research of the impact of interventions of food security and nutrition would require the random selection of participants and the random selection of a control from a similar population. This is quite simply inhumane if you're talking about deprivation and starving of people in order to determine the impact of not having that particular policy. But as I work in the applied science field, I want to draw a few more examples of ethical quandaries encountered by the application of science and the assessment of policy impact, and to show how many of these new metrics are pushing us beyond the boundaries of ethical conduct. We've heard much about the ethics of fundamental science, and I certainly used and draw on this research in the science that I practice. But as I'm not an expert in foundational science, it would be unethical for me to go down giving examples along that route. So I wish to give examples from policy research to underscore the necessity of ethical conduct and conducting research that requires input from various different disciplines. So I have a strong moral imperative in applying my mind to research where progress can make an impact on people's lives. This is strongly influenced by being a fifth generation offspring of migrants from the Netherlands, Ireland, and England, who sought a new beginning, were shipwrecked, or were fleeing the famine. From this, I grew up in a privileged, albeit middle class, family in South Africa. Around me, the injustices and suffering of repression etched the desire to make a difference in my country and on the continent. While I cannot afford for 1 minute to claim that I understand what it's like to walk in the shoes of many of my fellow South Africans, I do commit to trying to help and at least to raise the profile of these daily sufferings. But where do you start? Many of the most pressing research questions in today's society are complex and complicated. Untangling them requires that you move beyond your siloed science and include researchers from other disciplines. Whether this is tackled in a multidisciplinary or a transdisciplinary fashion depends on the skills of the research leader and the willingness of the team to move beyond the comfort of their own disciplines to working in a truly integrative manner. There are challenges and limitations to both approaches, but transdisciplinary approaches are often more messy. They're more less linear, and they require the inclusion of members of society that we don't traditionally see as part of the research team. So the need for such approaches raises a number of interesting questions on the ethical conduct of science. Participants in such work requires a re-look at our typical knowledge production systems and paying attention to issues in the ethical conduct that perhaps do not surface in traditional science fields, but that overlap with ethics in law, social sciences, and economics. So food security itself is firmly entrenched in the same human rights as the Nuremberg Code, and looking at finding ways in which we can help to respect the rights of people to gain food, to protect their access to food, for governments to fulfill the need and the means of being able to access those and ensuring the equitable distribution of food and stepping in when necessary to provide for people in need. So most development plans in countries ensure food security for all people. Yet governments are struggling to identify what this means and what is necessary to achieve these goals. even more so in Africa, where food insecurity is fragile and the cost and the risks involved with inappropriate policy choice could throw millions into starvation. So food is both a means for peace, but it's also a mechanism of manipulation, threatening to topple governments or win votes for power. So research in this domain carries an enormous burden, a political, economic, social, and cultural burden that's deeply interlinked and fragile. Given the complexity of these issues, how do politicians decide on which decisions to take? While probably not appropriate to say, most decisions are probably taken without us, without the evidence base of science, largely because we're not good at packaging our work or getting it onto the table of the politician, or we simply don't engage at all. To change this, we need relationships and trust. But do we lose our independence in building this trust? Swaying to political objectives when perhaps the research evidence suggests otherwise? Do we act responsibly? Do we have the knowledge necessary to guide policy? Is it timely, salient, and relevant? Do we shrink away in fear or boldly state what we know? How do we handle conflicting evidence? What if it's biased? What if it's miscalculated? What if it's misguided? So we need to become conscious of the need for independent research, but also for the need for consensus. Individuals cannot play the policy advisory role alone. None of us is capable of covering the entire scope of what is necessary to find the best fit scenario for complex policy decisions in food security. So we have to draw on a body of vast existing knowledge that often extends beyond what we are familiar with. While systemic reviews and Delphi techniques can find common themes, commonalities, and individuals and machines can try to conduct vast analyses of looking for patterns, appropriate policy options and guidance to decision makers can only come through individuals, through the scientific literature that we bring to the table and to the recommendations. These applications of technology may well sharpen our future prospects for predicting outcomes of a particular policy or a course of action, but they also are learning from our past action, so we need to look at how we can help them to understand the future. So I've mentioned that policy is context-specific, but often we develop blueprints. We also need to question who we speak for in these debates. For those of us privileged to have the opportunities to engage with policymakers, who are we speaking for? Scientists or for society? Are we speaking of people or with people? We require multidisciplinary engagement, but how qualified are we to make decisions and to speak on topics that are outside our domain? How do we deal with contradictions, particularly contradictions in ideology? How do we make sure that we can make the best fit? Sometimes we manipulate the results. For example, in my own field of agricultural economics, students often tell me my model doesn't fit. It doesn't come up with the answer that's required. Can I do, and they name a number of manipulations? No. There's such a culture of not publishing negative results, but in policy, negative results have many things to learn. If the model doesn't fit, we probably shouldn't be implementing that particular policy. What about the sampling techniques and replicability in social science research? This is often challenged by more traditional approaches. So policy research is really capturing the moment of who's in the room. It's very seldom able to be replicated, but it needs to be trustworthy. Whose data are we using? How are we using herd mentality in our conclusions? So a study we did of a systematic review of 169 studies on food security showed that only 9 researched poverty, yet over a third concluded that poverty was the cause of food insecurity. There's an ethical and moral issue in that. So this is where consensus studies come into play. Many recent policy dialogues have seen scientists coming around the table with multidisciplinary teams with various conflicting ideas and trying to find the best practices, share examples, and find the lessons against this background of solid science. These dialogues create heated debates from scientists of different persuasions. But it's very important that they bring to the table the complexities and also the contextual elements of our science. So it takes these experts to make sense of the science and summarize it in ways that are digestible to policy analysts. I've been part of three efforts in this regard, and they've shaped the way in which I conduct my research and also my impatience, I think, with many of the processes that I've been involved in otherwise. So the high-level panel of experts, which is the Committee on Food Security's approach to these consensus studies, has done many reports on critical food security issues and becomes now the debate and the foundation of the annual conferences on the Committee on Food Security. So after 40 years of science, of debates, the Committee on Food Security realized that the missing element was the science component and science advice. The IAP reports that we've been presenting on during this conference are another one of those exercises, where we looked at regional level and then consolidated this at global level, feeding into the S20's preparation and becoming a model for other reports on climate change and health and other approaches to looking at this vast body of complex knowledge. The Malaba-Montpellier panel brings about a different element of trying to change the narrative on agricultural development in Africa. This particular group takes a totally different approach. Instead of evaluating the failures of Africa, which are very well published, it looks at where are the successes, where are the shining stars, and what can we learn from positive stories of policy influence, rather than only focusing on the negative. All of these identify gaps in knowledge and lead to the beginning of new research to identify where we have data gaps and how data can fill these, as well as what are the new areas that policymakers need advice in. So in concluding, each discipline has its own ethical considerations, but increasingly we pressed into showing that our work has policy relevance, has influenced policy, and led to tangible change. While many of us would love to claim this, I think it is unethical for us to do this in many instances. So if you think of policy cycles are very short, politicians are in power for 4 to 5 years, even they struggle to get policies changed. And now in the short phase of a cycle, we're expected to show the same. So I wonder if the entire research system is not expecting too much of us. Should this criterion apply to all research? Is the requirement not creating expectations that can lead to unethical practices that go beyond the traditional classifications of misrepresentation and misconduct? Herd mentality and conclusions mislead and guide policymakers. We need some form of moderation. We need the seasoned reasoning around the table, and we need a moral compass that can guide us in identifying these critical components and guiding our action in this domain. So the responsibilities for policy influence are exceptionally high. The risks of public policy experiments and misinformation can have significant consequences for achieving the very goals at the center of the Sustainable Development Goals, to leave no one behind in development. As the fourth industrial revolution brings about more and more data, increases our capacity for analysis of large sets of data, machine learning tells us more about how we act. When it comes to policy support, there can be no substitute for sound ethical conduct of independent research across multiple domains and a need for building consensus on complex public matters. Thank you.